Viktor Frankl said, "Everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of the human freedoms. To choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's way." This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson. Stay tuned for the next hour as Sue explores the human psyche, what makes us tick, and how to live better, more fulfilled, and more meaningful lives. Only on 101.9 High FM.
Hello, this is Sue, and I'm back this week with Dr. Martin Stern, MBE. He was with me last week, and there was such fantastic response. You can't believe, Martin, the interest that you generated. I asked you if you'd listened to the podcast, and you said, no, you don't listen to yourself again. Welcome, Martin. Martin is a retired medical specialist, and he's a Holocaust survivor. Now he spends a lot of his time on Holocaust education. He lives in Britain. Are you in London, Martin, or in Leicester?
Yes, indeed. North London.
North London. Okay. How's the heat today?
It's very pleasant at the moment. We've had a heat wave and there's another one coming, but we've got a respite between them.
Oh, good.
So how's the winter in South Africa?
It's been really cold. That's why I've got this hat on.
Yeah, we've got summer, of course.
Now, Martin's parents were German and they had to flee to the Netherlands because his father was a German Jew and his mother was non-Jewish and they were forbidden to marry in Germany. So they fled to Netherlands and Martin was born there. At the age of two, the Nazis invaded the Netherlands. Martin's mother died in childbirth when his sister was born. He was sent to a non-Jewish family, a friend of his father's. His father had been an architect, and this was a friend of his from those days. And inadvertently, at the age of five, Martin identified his foster father, and he and his sister were sent to Westerbork transit camp, and then to Theresienstadt concentration camp in Prague. You know, Martin, your story just is one of loss, and it's an unbelievable courage. I mean, you're a little boy of five. I sent you the different questions that had come through. And what I wanted to ask you, in that time, as a little boy of five, what was your worst experience that you can recall?
It's difficult to say. I mean, you know, when I arrived in Westerbork prison camp in the Netherlands, the first thing I can remember being told is don't go closer than however many meters to that high barbed wire fence, because the soldiers in those watchtowers have guns and they will shoot you dead. The other thing is standing there watching the trains of goods trucks and cattle trucks being crammed with my fellow prisoners.
Who were children? Were they mostly children?
No, adults most of the time. But I was standing there on the sidelines close to the railway spur where this was happening. And, of course, that wasn't very funny. Not knowing what was going on. I don't remember ever seeing my sister, although she was in that camp at the same time. But it was quite crowded, and not as crowded as it had been, because by that stage in 1944, most European Jews were already dead. and that applied in the Netherlands as well. So It was not as crowded as it had been at its most crowded. And then really the worst time came during the railway journey, because although I went to a different destination, the railway journey I went on was like the railway journey of people who went to Auschwitz. A cattle truck crammed with people. You couldn't sit down or lie down. One bucket for a toilet, and A man died next to me. I didn't realize he had died. I was asking the adults around me why he was sleeping with his eyes wide open. And of course, no food and no drink. I think at one stage, an enameled mug of water was passed in. Probably the bucket was, the door was open to let empty the bucket. I don't know. My memory is vague.
And did any of the adults try to calm you or speak to you, the adults in that truck?
At the beginning, yes. Actually, we left Theresienstadt, we left Westerbork on a passenger train. And in the passenger train, I was in conversation with the adults, asking them where we were going. And apart from the fact they didn't tell me, more importantly, they didn't let on that they had no idea, that they didn't know. We weren't in that passenger train for long. We were then unloaded at a railway station and put into the cattle truck. So I usually miss the passenger train bit out from the story to save time. But at the beginning, yes, we were talking to each other. I think, you know, towards the end, everybody was so miserable, nobody was really speaking, as far as I can remember.
And your sister, who was she being held in someone's arms, or?
Well, at the beginning, in the passenger train, she was, a little baby in a beautiful white crocheted baby shawl. Perfectly clean and white, and big holes in it in the pattern. And I was worried she'd get cold.
Aww.
With a draft going through the holes. And the woman who was holding her opposite me in this passenger railway compartment reassured me that precisely because of the holes that it would trap air, and I mean, she didn't explain the physics, but she tried to reassure me that my sister would be okay. And the adults generally were trying to be reassuring. But in the cattle truck, as the journey went on, I don't think there was any conversation after a while.
Martin, one of the questions that came through was your mom died in childbirth. Or shortly after, of septicemia, and your sister was taken in by another friend of your father's. But when did you know that you had a sister?
Oh, I guess probably the day after she was born. I mean, I was with friends of my parents, and I did go and visit my mother in the hospital before she fell ill and as she was dying. I mean, I remember nurses trying to force her to drink, and she didn't want to drink. And she had wooden boards up at the side of the bed to stop her falling out. So I guess she must have had febrile convulsions or been in danger of that. I mean, this was all very unpleasant to watch. And she was, I remember her lying on her side facing me and making me promise that I would look after my little sister. So, aww, you know, she clearly understood that she was dying.
Good heavens. It's just shocking to think of a little boy having to go through that. For anyone who would like to hear the first part of Martin's story, which is very important because this is the second part, you know, we did the podcast last week, so it's on the Chai FM podcast under Finding Human, Sue Jackson, and you'll see it there. And I really suggest that you do listen to it. It was on the 1st of July. Now, because there were so many questions that came out of there. Martin, one of the other things that people wanted to know, because we got up to the part where the Russians came in to Theresienstadt camp and liberated the camp. The camp was full of typhus at the time, so you didn't see many Russians staying there. What happened to you once you were freed?
Well, we stayed in Theresienstadt for some weeks.
With that Mrs. de Jong, who had almost adopted you and your sister.
Indeed. Mm. I mean, I never saw a Soviet soldier because I was confined to the dormitory we were in when they arrived. And by the time I was allowed out in the morning, they'd gone very wisely because typhus can destroy an army very quickly.
Absolutely. And we're going to get back to that shortly.
This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson, only on 101.9 High FM.
Hi, this is Sue Jackson, and I'm back with Dr. Martin Stern. And he's got an MBE, by the way, so if you want to hear how he got that and what the Queen said to him, I suggest you listen to the first podcast. Very interesting. You can telegram us if you have any questions or opinions you want to share on 061-895-1019. Martin, we were talking about when Theresienstadt concentration camp was liberated by the Russians. You had typhus, you had to stay away from everybody. And Mrs. de Jong was with you and your sister still. And you appear to absolutely adore Mrs. de Jong. Why? What was it about her that you loved so much?
Well, firstly, I didn't have typhus, but Mrs. de Jong took great care that I did not go anywhere near the prisoners who had been marched to Theresienstadt from the extermination camps. They had the typhus mostly. I think it was spreading amongst the people who had been in Theresienstadt before. But I escaped actually catching it. It's not that I was never ill. I got terrible jaundice at one stage, and she told me to keep out of sight because if I was seen like that, I would be killed. But yes, absolutely. I mean, she was like a mother to me. And I have to say that she kept us in women's dormitories, which changed all the time. At one stage, it was a tiny side room off the back of a large dormitory. The side room had about, I think, six women and my sister and myself. And I have to say the other women also, I mean, you know, something motherly, or she told me to call them auntie. And it was a bit like that. So she was very protective, and the protection was really quite remarkably effective. Although the women went to slave labor very early in the day and came back very tired very late in the day, so contact was limited. But such as it was, it was, you know, I was lucky to be amongst people who were amazingly, wonderfully supportive to a little boy.
But you must have been a very lonely little boy as well when they all went out to work.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And during the day, the adults were doing slave labor. The women were splitting mica, a mineral related to asbestos, which the Nazis wanted to be split into little sheets that are as transparent as glass and resist heat. So it was used for stoves, furnaces, and electrical insulation. Other prisoners were making coffins. This is the Nazi sense of humor. You know, until I started reading up about this, I thought, how extraordinary, a concentration camp, and the prisoners are being buried in coffins. What luxury in a concentration camp. But the coffins were not for the inmates. They were for German citizens outside Theresienstadt. And the Nazis forced the some of the adult prisoners to manufacture coffins. And there were other things like that. I mean, very much a reminder of death. I mean, one of the methods of transport in Theresienstadt was a hearse. You know, a cart for transporting coffins. Mm, mm, and again, this is, the Nazis' mental torture.
How sickening.
But I was protected from that by these wonderful women.
And yet you did see it.
Especially Mrs. de Jong, yeah.
You did see it, though, so it must have had an impact on this little mind.
I didn't know how to interpret it, but I did see it.
So when you were actually liberated and you and your sister were allowed to leave, what then happened to you? Were you allowed to stay with Mrs. de Jong?
Yes, after some weeks, we were loaded onto big army lorries. I was in the back of an army lorry with a small number of adult men. And Mrs. de Jong, because she had my by now 2-year-old sister with her, was allowed to sit in the driver's cab next to the driver. And the convoy of lorries started traveling. And as it was traveling during the night, my sister, what happened, Mrs. de Jong fell asleep against the door of the cab. And the door opened and my sister rolled off her lap onto the roadway as the convoy was traveling at night. I didn't see this, of course. I was in the back of the lorry and I was probably asleep. But the next day, Mrs. de Jong told me about this. The lorry had stopped and my sister had been picked off the roadway.
Was she unhurt or what
had happened? Yes, I went up to my sister and really I didn't know I was going to be a doctor, but I think I examined her quite thoroughly and all she had was a few very superficial skin abrasions.
Good heavens.
Otherwise she was fine, but
miraculously fine.
Yes, I mean, if you've seen an army lorry and know how high they are, they're built for ground clearance.
Absolutely.
My sister could have died
falling
out of that lorry easily.
Now, you were not allowed to stay with Mrs. de Jong. So what happened once that decision was made? Or when was it
made? Well, the journey back was quite horrible. We traveled by lorry. We were, when the lorry stopped in one place, we were told to have showers. By this, to further get rid of the lice and with the danger of the typhus that they carried. And by this stage, the women had heard about gas chambers. Although they, in Theresienstadt, it was generally assumed that people going out were going to their deaths. People didn't know how. But by this stage, they knew they'd heard about gas chambers and they totally refused to have a shower. Hmm. I mean, they were now being transported by Allied troops. Americans, I think, there may have been Canadian or British, I'm not sure. But even though they were in the hands of rescuers, they absolutely would not have a shower. Mm-hmm. And they totally, very fiercely stopped me from having a shower. So we were deloused by having copious quantities of white DDT powder sprinkled into our clothes. I remember, my underwear being pulled away from my skin and DDT powder poured between the clothes and the skin. And then part of the journey was by train and part of the journey was on the bottom of a Rhine barge, an enormous freight barge. And we were in the bottom. This is by now in June in the summer. And it was hot and it stank like unbelievably. Very oppressive atmosphere, just one hatch to the outside, which we tried to go close to when, our turn came.
And where was the barge taking you?
take it from, I would think, somewhere in Germany to the Netherlands. And we arrived in the Netherlands. The couple that had been looking after my sister before she was caught, were waiting on the quayside as we came off the barge. But we went to Mrs. de Jong's home in Amsterdam, in her flat, typical Amsterdam canal side house, terraced house. And we spent one night there with her. And then the family that had looked after my sister came and took us away from Mrs. de Jong.
Oh, so many goodbyes, Martin. Good heavens.
Yeah, I can remember looking out of the car window from the back seat and waving goodbye
Oh.
to her as she was leaning out of a window.
Did you realize it was going to be more or less a permanent goodbye, or did you think it would be shorter?
Well, they didn't tell me much. I didn't really understand, but it became obvious.
And how did she react to letting the two of you go?
Well, she was very distressed. But she, I mean, she had just come back from captivity, from being in danger of her life. Her husband, her Jewish husband, had disappeared. She assumed that he had died in a concentration camp. He only came back later. He had survived. And when I found her again in the 1980s, after she had been denied access to us and we'd lost all contact, her husband had died. And this was one of the great sorrows of her life, that she had not been able to show my sister and I to her husband.
How sad, really. And so then, where did you stay in the Netherlands, or what happened to you and your sister?
Well, my sister was taken by this older couple in a village near the coast west of Amsterdam. And I was sent to the woman who'd looked after me during the war, whose husband had died in Neuengamme concentration camp for looking after me. And I spent some weeks with her, started school right in the center of Amsterdam, in a school within sight of the Royal Palace in the center of Amsterdam, and really very central. And every day I walked past the church next to the house where Anne Frank had been hidden, although I
Didn't
didn't know
know.
about Anne Frank, of course,
And they were a
at that time.
non-Jewish family, is that right?
Yes, they were not Jewish. Their husband had been an architect, and my father and
Okay.
he had trained together. He and his wife had become firm friends of my parents. But then one day, this wonderful woman, who I also loved, told me that when I came home from school, I should wait in the square outside the school, and I would be picked up by someone else. And I didn't understand what was going on. I was 7 years old at this stage. But a man picked me up and took me to his home in Amsterdam South, a rather salubrious area. Actually, he lived on the same square where Anne Frank had lived before she went into hiding. But so I was on the opposite side of the square, but as a child, I played on the same paving stones as Anne Frank. Again, I had no idea about this, of course, but
But you didn't know him at all, the man who collected
well, I
you?
had actually seen him during the war, but I was not aware of that at that time.
So why were you given to him? Why did he collect you?
The family that had stolen us from Mrs. de Jong had persuaded the lady who looked after me to let me go to their son and daughter-in-law who lived in Amsterdam South.
What was the reason for that, Martin?
Well, they persuaded her that my sister and I would be together, and she thought that maybe that took priority over her wish to keep me in my interests. But in fact, I didn't immediately join my sister. I lived in Amsterdam for a couple of years and went to three different schools in Amsterdam before eventually I was moved to the family that had my sister.
Had you been asking to see your sister before then?
Well, I did see my sister from time to time. I mean, the son visited his parents and then I would see my sister. So I did see her. I knew where she was. And
Martin, why did you end up in Leicester in Britain?
Well, the woman of the family I ended up with in the Netherlands died quite unexpectedly, suddenly, overnight. And the husband felt that he couldn't look after us. There were some reasons for that to do with his circumstances. And we had family in Manchester clamoring to have us. My father's sister, my aunt, and my grandmother.
So there was the Jewish part of your family.
My father's mother, yeah, was in Manchester. So I moved to Britain at the age of 12, had to learn English. You know, I'm speaking to you in my second language. I try to get by. I went to a wonderful school, Manchester Grammar School, and a wonderful university, the University of Oxford, trained in medicine. But I came to Britain as an immigrant with culture shock, even though the Netherlands and Britain are very close and culturally very similar. You can still have culture shock.
I'm quite sure we're going to get back to that.
This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson, only on 101.9 High FM.
Hello, this is Sue, and I'm back with Dr. Martin Stern, and we are talking about his experiences when he left the concentration camp, was in the Netherlands, and we are now up to where he got to London, to England. And if you'd like to telegram us, please do so on 061-895-1019. This is 101.9 High FM. Martin, you were saying that it was still a culture shock, even though in many ways it wasn't that different. But I'm very interested to know, you were a young boy still then. Did you ever feel settled because you'd been moved so often and taken away from people that you cared about? And you must have had to block a lot of feelings to survive.
Yes, I mean, it was very difficult. I think each move from family to family successively became harder. I guess part of the explanation is that as you mature, your ideas become more fixed and it becomes more difficult to adapt. As a small child, you're very, very adaptable and take things for granted. You know, you accept abnormal things as being normal.
And did you make friends? Were you able to make friends?
Yes, I did. I mean, when I first went to school in the Netherlands, I really didn't interact with the other children in the class. I was just not used to interacting with other children. I'd not been allowed to for several years. But that became more normal. I'm not sure that it ever became entirely normal. I mean, it left traces even in my adult life, I'm sure. But you know, I was fortunate, I think, with my schools, and particularly Manchester Grammar School was a wonderful environment where I made perfectly normal, good friendships, which I still treasure. So there was a kind of gradual process. But also, I mean, to be blunt, I was moved from people who I was, loved and was close to people who, gradually more dysfunctional families. The last family in the Netherlands was dysfunctional in a serious way, and the family in Manchester was. So with that background, it was very hard.
It must have been incredibly hard. Was there a time when you actually did feel safe again? I know that you did get married and you had your own children. How old were you at that stage when you were able to go into a relationship? I mean, I feel that that is absolutely remarkable. It says so much about you, that you were able to allow yourself to go into a relationship and have children when you yourself had been so hurt.
Yes, I mean, my wife died 5 years ago after we'd been married for a couple of weeks short of 50 years. And it was, I have to say, it was not an easy marriage. I did not make a wise choice. And I can see in retrospect why that happened. I was very stressed. And under stress, I made a bad decision.
And how old were you then?
I married in my 30s, so I married rather late. And the same was true for my wife. But we had children, I love them dearly and live close to them, and we interact a lot. That's incredibly important in my life, and my grandchildren, seven grandchildren. But let me tell you about my sister. She died in 2007 of cancer of the bile duct, but she also had a very hard time, and being 4 years younger than me, I think that she had a much harder time than I did, simply because when you are younger, you are more easily harmed in your development and more seriously harmed in your development. In addition to that, she was treated in entirely different ways, badly. In the Dutch family. I mean, they spoilt her rotten. So on the surface, they were very loving and did everything for her. But in a more fundamentally, they turned her into a spoilt, self-entitled adult. Not her fault. She didn't choose to be brought up like that. But she had difficulty interacting with people to the end of her life. She did marry, but never had children. Now, she was only 2 years old when the war ended. I believe she did not remember anything that happened during the war. She thought she did, but I think those were false memories, and there was nothing she claimed to remember that you couldn't get out of a book,
And did you
whereas I
remain,
could.
did you stay close to her emotionally?
No,
Were you?
this is the huge problem, that because she was spoilt rotten and I was treated rather harshly. I mean, when the family went on holiday, they left me behind with the housekeeper, whilst they took my sister. I mean, just one illustration of the kind of offhand way I was treated. It was very obvious and made quite clear to me that I was there for the benefit of my sister. I was not there for myself. And then we moved to England, where my sister was treated very harshly.
Gosh.
And I was, again, treated rather favorably. And again, I don't say that as a positive thing. I think that the best thing to do with a child is to treat it normally.
Absolutely.
And I think a kind of show of love, which is in fact not, let's say, complicated. Yeah. It's problematic.
Absolutely.
But, you know, just as was the case with, I think, as far as I know, all my sister's friends, it starts off nice and then difficulties develop. But she married and never had children. And I don't know exactly why she didn't have children, but my guess is that it was because of her difficult childhood after the war. After the war.
Yes, yeah.
The way she was treated, it superficially, she was valued and treated nicely, but she was harmed. And and she did have a difficult life. Absolutely don't envy her life at all.
So did she get to know your children and your wife?
Oh, yes. And well, she was very loving towards my children. Yes, interacted positively with my wife. I don't think she had any insight any more than I did at that time into what was happening in the marriage. It took me about 40 years for a penny to drop what the fundamental cause of the problem was.
Do you think that also?
Even though I was a doctor.
Do you think that also came from this very dysfunctional childhood that you were put through?
Oh yes,
through?
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, such things happen to people who don't have such traumatic childhoods. But I think I was made more. You know, it was much more likely in the case of somebody like myself. Disorientated by a traumatic childhood. But I just. You know, my sister did marry, although she didn't have children. Mm. She married a Portuguese refugee in the Netherlands.
Mm.
Now, why a Portuguese refugee in the Netherlands, for goodness sake?
Well, why not?
Well, after the Second World War, Portugal still had a fascist dictator.
Oh.
Salazar. And Portugal had colonies in Africa.
Yes.
Mozambique, Angola. Mm. He was drafted into the Portuguese army and sent to Angola to fight the Angolans who were fighting for their independence.
Mm.
Now, Rolando Silva did not think that he should be shooting Angolans for wanting to be independent. He thought they should be independent. And he definitely didn't think he should murder them for that wish.
So he escaped.
But he was a soldier.
Mm-hmm.
He had to obey orders. So what did he do? One day, as the soldiers were on parade, you know, his unit, he ran out of the line, pretended to go mad, and slapped his commanding officer in the face.
Yes.
For which he got put in military prison. Now, in military prison, he couldn't be killing Angolans. So round one to Rolando Silva.
Good for him.
Right?
We'll get back to that. Thank you, Craig.
This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson, only on 101.9 High FM.
Hello, this is Sue Jackson, and I'm back with Dr. Martin Stern. Martin, we're going to have to leave your Orlando da Silva for now. Because I just wanted to move on, because we're going to be told to wrap up, I know, fairly shortly. But you only started talking about the Holocaust after you yourself had a tremendous health scare with a massive heart attack. Did you tell your children about your experiences, or did you tell strangers initially?
Really, from my early time in Amsterdam at age 7, I stopped talking about it, and as did most other Holocaust survivors. And this phenomenon was known to historians as the Great Silence.
Mm.
Most of us only started speaking later in life. Further research has shown that the problem wasn't that the survivors didn't want to talk about it. It's the hearers didn't want to hear it. They were not interested.
Mm, mm.
And it's now known as the Great Deafness.
Mm.
And as you say, I had a heart attack. I realized if I didn't speak, nobody would know. The Holocaust deniers. I thought I should talk about it. And at that stage, I told some of my colleagues at work, although just a few. And then I was invited by the Christian family running the National Holocaust Museum in Britain to come and talk after I retired. And I've been doing that for 21 years.
Amazing.
And we now are having a great rethink because we have been trying to educate school children about the Holocaust for about 25 years. And following the October the 7th atrocities in Israel, and we realize, and the disgusting demonstrations in favor of the perpetrators in London and elsewhere, we realize that what we've done is not enough. So we're having to really rethink what it is fundamentally that is wrong with people, that makes them praise mass murder, rape, child killing in the most horrific ways, and an intent of genocide.
Absolutely.
You know, the South African government has accused the Israeli government of genocide, whereas in fact, it was Hamas that wished to commit genocide against the population of Israel.
Absolutely.
The Israelis did not want to commit genocide or anything remotely like it against the Gazans. In fact, the people who were murdered by Hamas and by their hangers-on, you know, Gazan civilians who joined in, although they were not recruited into Hamas, they joined in enthusiastically things so horrific that I can't describe them on this radio channel. Those people who were murdered were actually trying to help the Gazans and had been doing, you know, promoting friendship and the improvement of the circumstances of the Gazans. So the inversion of reality, the people who believe a stupid fairy tale rather than facing reality, this is a horror. And we in the National Holocaust Museum in Britain are the foremost organization that is really rethinking how we have to approach education. Because if we're to have a better future, we've got to make people better able to understand reality, not the fantasies in their minds.
And to question, and you know, there was a quote by you which said, there are two types of people in the world, those to whom you can't explain and those to whom you don't need to explain. And I thought that was incredibly interesting because what you're saying there is that some people, well, especially which we're seeing now, educated people at universities and what have you, who are not understanding. So, that you know, they, how do you explain to them?
Well, you know, German, top world-class German universities played a major part in the rise of Nazism.
Mm.
More of people in those universities joined the Nazi party than in other parts of society, and more enthusiastically, and they became Nazi leaders.
Mm.
Get that. And there is something very seriously wrong with our universities in the United States, in Britain, and all around the world, that people leave with a great fanfare and a ceremony wearing academic gowns and with degree certificates. And they are technically very competent in some kind of subject, but their general understanding of life is scarily abysmal.
Absolutely.
And a philosopher called Alistair MacIntyre, in a book called After Virtue, it says that people are left with remnants, little isolated principles from religions and sophisticated cultural systems of the past. And they rely entirely on these mini quotes from the Bible and other sources.
Absolutely.
And because they don't have the richness of the context, they completely misinterpret and misuse them. And he talks about something called emotivism.
And we're going
people
to have to get
with
back
their
to
their emotions.
That. Absolutely. On that note, we're going to have to, I've been told to wrap up. But you know, the Lubavitch Rebbe Schneerson said, unity is not sameness. Unity is love that makes room for difference. And thank you, Martin, so much. There's so much more. I want to get back to Mrs. de Jong and how you started that relationship. You found her again in the 1980s. And there's so much I still want to talk to you about. So thank you so much for spending this time with me.